Chapter 10 At Tsushin Highlands. Love is lust made meaningful. Hope is hunger made human. Agensis, the third analytic of men. How does one learn innocence? How does one teach ignorance? For to be them is to know them not. And yet they are the immovable point from which the compass of life swings, the measure of all crime and compassion, the rule of all wisdom and folly. They are the absolute. Anonymous, the Imprompta. Late summer, 4111, year of the Tusk, Gadean interior. Peace had come. A Commian had dreamed of war, more war than anyone save a mandate schoolman could dream. He'd even witnessed war between nations. The three seas bred quarrels as readily as did liquor. But he'd never belonged to one. He had never marched as he marched now, sweating beneath the Gadean sun, surrounded by thousands of iron-armored men, by the lowing of oxen and the tramping of countless sandaled feet. War, in the smoke darkening the horizon, in the braying of horns, in the great carnival of encampment after encampment, in the blackened stone and whitened dead. War, in past nightmares and future apprehensions, everywhere war. And somehow, peace had come. There was Kellis, of course. Since resolving not to inform the mandate of his presence, Akamian's anguish had receded, then fallen away altogether. How this could be mystified him for the most part. The threat remained. Kellis was, Akamian would remind himself from time to time, the harbinger. Soon the sun would rise behind the no-god and cast his dread shadow across the three seas. Soon the second apocalypse would rack the world. But when he thought of these things, a queer elation warmed his horror, a drunken exhilaration. Akamian had always been incredulous of stories of men breaking ranks in battle to charge their foe. But now he thought he understood the impulse behind that heedless rush. Consequences lost all purchase when they became mad. And desperation, when pressed beyond anguish, became narcotic. He was the fool who dashed alone into the spears of thousands. For Kellis. Akamian still taught him during the day-long march, though now both Esmenet and Serwe accompanied them, sometimes chatting to each other, but mostly just listening. Surrounding them, men of the Tusk marched in their thousands, bent beneath their packs, sweating in the bright Gadean sun. Somehow, impossibly, Kellis had exhausted everything Akamian knew of the three seas, so they talked of the ancient north, of Seswatha, and his world of bronze, Srank, and non-men. Soon, Akamian realized, from time to time, he would have nothing left to give Kellis, save the Gnosis. Which he could not give, of course. But he found it hard to resist wondering what Kellis, with his godlike intellect, would make of it. Thankfully, the Gnosis was a language for which the prince possessed no tongue. The marches tumbled to a halt sometime between mid-afternoon and dusk, depending on the terrain and, most important, the availability of water. Gadea was a dry land, the Tsushin Highlands especially so. After the brisk routine of pitching camp, they gathered about Zynemus's fire, though Akamian often found himself eating alone with Esmenet, Serwe, and Zynemus's slaves. More and more, Zynemus, Naor, and Kellis supped with Proyas, who, under the Skilvendi's coarse tutelage, had become a man obsessed with strategy and planning. But usually they all found themselves about the fire for an hour or two before retiring to their pallets or mats. And here, as everywhere else, Kellis shone. One night, shortly after the Holy War had left Hinnereth, they found themselves eating a contemplative meal of rice and lamb, which Naor had secured for them the previous day. Commenting on the luxury of eating steaming meat, Esmenet asked the whereabouts of their provider.
With Proyas, Zynema said, discussing war.
What could they possibly talk about all the time? Caught mid-swallow, Kellis held out a hand. I've heard them, he said, his eyes wry and bright. Their conversation sounds something like this. Esmenet was laughing already. Everyone else leaned forward eagerly. In addition to mischievous wit, Kellis had an uncanny gift for voices. Serwe fairly chortled with excitement. Kellis assumed an imperious and warlike face. He spat between his feet, then in a voice that raised goose pimples, so near was it to Nayor's own, he said,
"The people do not ride like sissies. They place one testicle to the left of the saddle, one testicle to the right, and they do not bounce, they are so heavy."
"I would," Kellis as Proyas replied, "be spared your impudence, Skilvendi."
Zynemus coughed a mouthful of wine.
"That is because you do not understand the ways of war," Kellis as Nayor continued. "They are hairy and they are dark, like the cracks of unwashed wrestlers. War is where the sandal of the world meets the scrotum of men."
"I would be spared your blasphemy, Skilvendi." Kellis spat into the fire.
"You think your ways are the ways of the people, but you are wrong. You are silly girls to us, and we would make love to your asses were they as muscular as those of our horses."
"I would be spared your affections, Skilvendi." "But you would live on," Esmenet cried out, "in the scars I cut into my arm." The camp fairly shrieked with laughter. Zynemus hung his head between his knees, shuddering and snorting. Esmenet rolled backward on her mat, screaming in her enticing and adorable way. Zenkappa and Dincheses leaned against each other, their shoulders jerking. Serwe had curled into a ball and seemed to weep with joy as much as laugh. Kellis merely smiled, looked about as though mystified by their hysterics. When Nayor arrived later that night, everyone fell silent, at once abashed and conspiratorial. Scowling, the Skilvendi paused before the fire, looking from face to grinning face. Akamian glanced at Serwe, was shocked by the malice in her smile. Suddenly, Esmenet burst out laughing.
"You should have heard, Kellis," she cried. "You sounded hilarious."
The Skilvendi's weathered face went blank. His murderous eyes became dull with, could it be? Then contempt regained the heights of his expression. He spat into the fire and strode off. His spittle hissed. Kellis stood, apparently stricken with remorse.
"The man's a thin-skinned lout," Akamian said crossly. "Mockery is a gift between friends, a gift."
The prince whirled. "Is it?" he cried. "Or is it an excuse?" Akamian could only stare, dumbstruck. Kellis had rebuked him. Kellis. Akamian looked to the others, saw his shock mirrored in their faces, though not his dismay.
"Is it?"
Kellis demanded. Akamian felt his face flush, his lips tremble. There was something about Kellis's voice, so like Akamian's father's.
Who was he to—
"Forgive me, Akka," the prince said, lowering his head as though stunned by his own outburst. "I punish you for my own folly. I act twice the fool." Akamian swallowed, shook his head, forced a smile.
"No, no, I apologize," his voice quavered. "I was too harsh."
Kellis smiled, leaned to place a hand on his shoulder. At his touch, Akamian's entire side went numb. For some reason, the prince's smell, leather with a hint of rose water, always flustered him.
"Then we're fools together," Kellis said.
There was delight and the brief uncanny sense that Kellis was expecting something.
"I've been saying that all along,"
Zynemus growled from the far side of the fire. The marshal's timing was impeccable, as usual. Esmenet led the charge of nervous laughter, and they recaptured something of their earlier cheer. Akamian found himself laughing as well. All of them at some point or another inevitably ran afoul of one another's humor. Zynemus would complain of Arissus, who would harp about Esmenet, who would gripe about Serwe, who would carp about Akamian, who would gripe about Zynemus. Too dense, too forward, too vain, too crude, and so on. All men were caste merchants in some respect, haggling and trading, but without scales or touchstones to confirm the weight or purity of their coinage. They had only guesswork, backbiting, petty jealousies, resentments, arguments, and third-party arbitration simply belonged to the market of men. But with Kellis, it was different. Somehow he managed to browse the market without opening his purse. Almost from the beginning, they'd recognized him as the judge, including Zynemus, who was the titular head of their fire. No doubt there was an uncertainty about him, a capriciousness appropriate to his brilliance, but these were simply departures from a profound and immovable center. Intelligence as penetrating as any in near or far antiquity. Compassion as broad as Inrao's and yet somehow far deeper. A benevolence born of understanding rather than forgiveness, as though he could see through the delinquent rush of thought and passion to the still point of innocence within each soul. And words, analogies that seized reality and burned it from the inside out. He possessed, Akamian sometimes thought, what the poet Protathus claimed all men should strive for, the hand of Triamus, the intellect of Agensis, and the heart of Sejanus. And others thought this as well. Every evening after the dinner fires burned low, men and women from every nation, it seemed, began gathering round the perimeter of Zynemus's camp, sometimes calling out to Kellis, but mostly keeping to themselves. A few in the beginning, then more and more, until they comprised a congregation of 36 or so souls. Soon Zynemus's Atrempans were leaving large swaths of empty pasture between their round tents and their marshal's pavilion. They would be supping with strangers otherwise. For the first week or so, everyone, including Kellis, did their best to ignore them, thinking this would shortly drive them away. Who, they wondered, would sit unacknowledged night after night watching others, watching strangers, take their repose? But like little brothers with no resources of their own, they persisted. Their numbers even multiplied. On a whim, Akamian took a seat among them one night and watched as they watched, hoping to understand what it was that drew them to so demean themselves. At first, he merely saw familiar figures illumined by firelight against a greater dark, Nayor sitting cross-legged, his back as broad as an Ainani fan and strapped with scarred muscle. Beyond him, on the far side of the fire, Zynemus upon his camp stool, hands on his knees, his square-cut beard brushing his chest as he laughed in response to Esmanet, who knelt beside him, muttering something wicked about somebody, no doubt. Dinchezis, Zenkapa, Orissus, Serwe leaning back on her mat, bouncing her knees together, innocently exposing warm and promising shadows. And next to her, Kellis, sitting serene and golden. Akamian glanced at those seated throughout the surrounding darkness. He saw men of the Tusk from every nation and caste. Some leaned together, talking amongst themselves. But most sat as he did, apart from their fellows, eyes sorting through the bright figures before them as though struggling to read by fading candlelight. They seemed ensorcelled, like fish drawn to a flashing lure, compelled not so much by the light as by the surrounding dark. "Why do you do this?" he asked the man sitting nearest to him, a blond Tidoni with a soldier's forearms and a caste noble's clear eyes. "Can't you see?" the man replied, without so much as glancing in his direction. "See what?" "See him." "You mean Prince Kellis?" The man turned to him, his smile at once beatific and filled with pity. "You're too close," he said. "That's why you can't see." "See what?" Akamian asked. His breath felt pinched. "He touched me once," the man inexplicably replied. "Before Asgiliok, I stumbled while marching, and he caught me by the arm. He said, 'Doff your sandals and shod the earth.'" Akamian chortled. "An old joke," he explained. "You must have cursed the ground when you stumbled." "So?" the man replied. He was fairly trembling, Akamian realized, with indignant fury. Akamian frowned, tried to smile to reassure. "Well, it's an old saying, ancient in fact, meant to remind people not to foist their failings on others." "No," the man grated, "it's not." Akamian paused. "Then what does it mean?" Rather than answer, the man had turned away as though willfully consigning Akamian and his question to the oblivion of what he couldn't see. Akamian stared at him for a thick moment, bewildered and curiously dismayed. How could fury secure the truth? He stood, slapped dust from his knees. "It means," the man said from behind him, "that we must uproot the world, that we must destroy all that offends." Akamian started, such was the hatred in the man's voice. He turned, to sneer or to scold, he wasn't sure which. Instead, he simply stared, dumbfounded. For whatever reason, the man couldn't match his gaze. He scowled at the firelight instead. Akamian glanced from him to the other faces in the darkness. Most had turned to the sound of angry voices, but even as he watched, they drifted back to Kellis in the light. And somehow, the schoolman simply knew these people wouldn't go away. I'm no different, he thought, feeling the perplexing twinge of insights into things already known. I simply sit closer to the fire. Their reasons were his reasons. He knew this. Their grounds were inchoate and innumerable. Grief, temptation, remorse, confusion. They watched out of weariness, out of clandestine hope and fear, out of fascination and delight. But more than anything, they watched out of necessity. They watched because they knew something was about to happen. Without warning, the fire popped, belching a geyser of sparks, one of which floated toward Kellis. Smiling, he glanced at Serwe, then reached out and pinched the point of orange light between thumb and forefinger, extinguished it. Several gasped in the darkness. As the days passed, more and more watchers gathered. The situation became doubly uncomfortable, both because their camp had become a peculiar stage, an enclosure of light surrounded by shadowy watchers, and because of Kellis's seething humor. The Prince of Atrathau had affected everyone who frequented Zynemus's fire, each according to their hopes and hurts, and to see the man who'd rewritten the ground of their understanding angry was troubling in the way of loved ones suddenly acting contrary to all expectations. One night, for reasons peculiar to his own brooding humor, Zynemus finally blurted,
"Damn it, Kellis, why don't you just talk to them?"
Stunned silence. Esmonette reached out, clutched Akamian's hand in the shadows between them. Only the Skilvendi continued eating, fingering gruel into his mouth. Akamian found himself repulsed, as though he witnessed something lewd and animal, a man too bent to the arch of his lust. "Because," Kellis said tightly, his eyes riveted upon the fire, "they make more of me than I am." "Do they?" Akamian thought. He knew the others asked themselves the same question, even though they rarely spoke of Kellis to one another. For some reason, a peculiar shyness afflicted them whenever the subject of Kellis arose, as though they harbored suspicions too foolish or too hurtful to reveal. Akamian could only really speak of him to Esmonette, and even then.
"So?"
Zynemus snapped. More than anyone, he seemed able to pretend that Kellis was simply another face about their fire.
"Go tell them!"
Kellis stared at the marshal for several unblinking moments, then nodded. Without a word, he stood and strode off into the darkness. And so began what Akamian came to call the Imprompta, the nightly talks, almost sermons, Kellis started giving to the men of the Tusk. Not always, but often, he and Esmonette would join him, watch from nearby as he answered questions, discussed innumerable things. He told the two of them that their presence gave him heart, that they reminded him he was no more than those to whom he spoke. He confessed a growing conceit, a thought that terrified because he found it easier and easier to bear. "So often when I speak," he said, "I don't recognize my voice." Akamian couldn't remember ever clutching Esmonette's hand so fiercely. The numbers attending began to swell, not so fast that Akamian could notice a difference between consecutive nights, but fast enough that several dozen had become hundreds by the time the Holy War neared Shygek. A handful of more devoted listeners would assemble a small wooden platform upon which they would lay a mat between two iron braziers. Kellis would sit cross-legged, poised and immobile between the shining flames. Usually he would wear a plain yellow cassock, looted, Serwe had told Akamian, from the Sapatishah's camp on the plains of Mengeta. And somehow, whether by posture, bearing, or some trick of the light, he would look unearthly, even glorious. One evening, for reasons he couldn't fully articulate, Akamian followed Kellis and Esmonette with a candle, his writing accoutrements, and a sheaf of parchment. The previous night, Kellis had spoken of trust and betrayal, telling the story of a fur trapper he'd known in the wastes north of Atrathau, a man who'd remained faithful to his dead wife by fostering a heartbreaking devotion to his dogs. "When one love dies," he'd said, "one must love another." Esmonette had openly wept. It just seemed that such words had to be written. With Esmanet, Akamian unrolled their mat to the left of Kellis's platform. Torches had been staked across the small field. The atmosphere was sociable, though hushed by something more than respect and not quite reverence. Akamian glimpsed more than a few familiar faces in the crowd. Several high-ranking caste nobles were present, including a square-jawed man wearing an Ansor general's blue cloak, General Sampas, or Martimus, Akamian believed. Even Proyas sat in the dust with the others, though he seemed troubled. He looked away instead of acknowledging Akamian's gaze. Kellis took his place between the potted fires. The resulting silence seemed to hiss. For several moments he seemed unbearably real, like the sole living man, something raw and tumid in a world of smoky apparitions. He smiled, and Akamian's chest, which had tightened like parched leather, relaxed to the point of feeling sodden. An unaccountable relief washed through him. Breathing deeply, he readied his quill, cursed as the first errant droplet of ink tapped onto the page. "Aka," Esmanet chided. As always, Kellis searched the faces of those before him, his eyes glinting with compassion. After a few heartbeats, his gaze settled upon one man, a Kunryan knight by the look of his tunic and the heft of his gold rings. Otherwise, he looked haggard, as though he still slept upon the battle plain. His beard was knotted with forgotten plaits. "What happened?" Kellis asked. The nameless knight smiled, but there was a strange and subtle incongruence in his expression, something like glimpsing the difference between white eyes and yellow teeth.
3 days ago, the man said, our lord heard rumor of a village some miles to the west, so we rode out, hoping for plunder.
Kellis nodded. And what did you find?
Nothing. I mean, no village. Our lord was wroth. He claims the others.
What did you find? The man blinked. Panic flashed from the stoic weariness of his expression.
A child, he said hoarsely. A dead child. We were following this trail, something worn by goatherds, I think, cutting across this hillside, and there was just this dead child, a girl, no more than 5 or 6, lying in our path. Her throat had been cut.
What happened next?
Nothing. I mean, we simply ignored her. Continued riding as though she were nothing more than discarded cloth, a scrap of leather in the dust.
He added, his voice breaking. He looked down to his calloused palms. Guilt and shame rack you by day, Kellis said. The feeling that you've committed some mortal crime. Nightmares rack you by night. She speaks to you. The man's nod was almost comical in its desperation. He hadn't, Akamian realized, the nerve for war.
But why? He cried. I mean, how many dead have we seen?
But not all seeing, Kellis replied, is witness.
I don't understand.
Witness is the seeing that testifies, that judges so that it may be judged. You saw and you judged. A trespass had been committed. An innocent had been murdered. You saw this.
Yes,
the man hissed.
A little girl. A little girl.
And now you suffer.
But why? He cried. Why should I suffer? She's not mine. She was heathen.
Everywhere, everywhere we're surrounded by the blessed and the cursed, the sacred and the profane. But our hearts are like hands. They grow callous to the world. And yet, like our hands, even the most callous heart will blister if overworked or chafed by something new. For some time, we may feel the pinch, but we ignore it because we have so much work to do. Kellis had looked down into his right hand. Suddenly he balled it into a fist, raised it high. And then one strike, with a hammer or a sword, and the blister breaks, our heart is torn. And then we suffer, for we feel the ache for the blessed, the sting of the cursed. We no longer see, we witness. His luminous eyes settled upon the nameless knight, blue and wise. This is what has happened to you.
Yes. Yes. But what should I do?
Rejoice.
Rejoice? But I suffer.
Yes.
Rejoice. The calloused hand cannot feel the lover's cheek. When we witness, we testify. And when we testify, we make ourselves responsible for what we see. And that is what it means to belong.
Kellis suddenly stood, leapt from the low platform, took two breathtaking steps into their midst.
Make no mistake, he continued, and the air thrummed with the resonance of his voice. This world owns you. You belong, whether you want to or not. Why do we suffer? Why do the wretched take their own lives? Because the world, no matter how cursed, owns us. Because we belong.
Should we celebrate suffering? A challenging voice called from somewhere.
Prince Kellis smiled, glancing into the darkness.
Then it's no longer suffering, is it?
The small congregation laughed.
No,
Kellis continued.
That's not what I mean. Celebrate the meaning of suffering. Rejoice that you belong, not that you suffer.
Remember what the latter prophet teaches us. Glory comes in joy and sorrow. Joy and sorrow.
I see the wisdom of your words, Prince, the nameless knight stammered. I truly see, but...
And somehow a Commian could feel his question. What is there to gain?
I'm not asking you to see, Kellis said. I'm asking you to witness.
Blank face, desolate eyes. The nameless knight blinked, and two tears silvered his cheek. Then he smiled, and nothing, it seemed, could be so glorious.
To make myself...
His voice quavered, broke.
To make...
To be one with the world in which you dwell, Kellis said. To make a covenant of your life.
The world. You will gain the world.
Akamian looked down to his parchment, realized he'd stopped writing. He turned, looked helplessly at Esmanette.
Don't worry, she said. I remember.
Of course she did. Esmanette, the second pillar of his peace and by far the mightier of the two.
It seemed at once strange and fitting to find something almost conjugal in the midst of the holy war. Each evening they would walk exhausted from Kellis's talks or from Zynemus's fire, holding hands like young lovers, ruminating or bickering or laughing about the evening's events. They would pick their way through the guy ropes, and a Commian would pull the canvas aside with mock gallantry. They would touch and brush as they disrobed, then hold each other in the dark, as though together they could be more than what they were. A whore of word and a whore of body. The greater world had receded into shadow. He thought of Inrau less and less over the days, and pondered the concerns of his life with Esmanette and Kellis more and more. Even the threat of the consult in the second apocalypse had become something banal and remote, like rumors of war among pale-skinned peoples. Seswatha's dreams still came as fierce as ever, but they dissolved in the softness of her touch, in the consolation of her voice.
Hush, Akka, she would say. It's only a dream.
And like smoke, the images, straining, groaning, spitting, and shrieking, would twist into nothingness. For once in his life, Akamian was seized by the moment, by now. By the small hurt in her eyes when he said something careless, by the way her hand drifted to his knee of its own accord whenever they sat together, by the nights they lay naked in the tent, her head upon his chest and her dark hair fanned across his shoulder and neck, speaking of those things only they knew.
Everyone knows,
she said one night after making love. They'd retired early, and they could hear the others. First mock protests and uproarious laughter, then utter quiet, bound by the magic of Kellis's voice. The fire still burned, and they could see it, muted and blurred across the dark canvas.
He's a prophet, she said.
Akamian felt something resembling panic.
What are you saying?
She turned to study him. Her eyes seemed to glitter with their own light.
Only what you need to hear.
And why would I need to hear that?
What had she said?
Because you think it, because you fear it, but most of all because you need it. We are damned, her eyes said.
I'm not amused, Esme.
She frowned, but as though she'd noticed nothing more than a tear in one of her new kyanine silks.
How long has it been since you've contacted Atyrsus? Weeks? Months?
What is it with—
You're waiting, Akka. You're waiting to see what he becomes.
Kellis?
She turned her face away, lowered her ear to his heart.
He's a prophet.
She knew him. When Akkamian thought back, it seemed that she'd always known him. He'd even thought her a witch when they met for the first time, not only because of the ever-so-faint mark of the charmed whore's shell that she used as a contraceptive, but because she guessed he was a sorcerer before he uttered scarcely 5 words.
From the very beginning, she seemed to have a talent for him, for Drusus Akkamian.
It was strange to be known, truly known, to be awaited rather than anticipated, to be accepted instead of believed, to be half another's elaborate habits, to see oneself continually foreshadowed in another's eyes. And it was strange to know. Sometimes she laughed so hard she belched, and when disappointed, her eyes dimmed like candles starved of air. She liked the feel of knives between her toes. She loved to hold her hand slack and motionless while his cock hardened beneath.
I do nothing, she would whisper, and yet you rise to me.
She was frightened of horses. She fondled her left armpit when deep in thought. She did not hide her face when she cried, and she could say things of such beauty that sometimes Akkamian thought his heart might stop for having listened. Details. Simple enough in isolation, but terrifying and mysterious in their sum, a mystery that he knew. Was that not love? To know? To trust a mystery? Once, on the night of Ishoya, which Conryon celebrated with copious amounts of that foul and flammable liquor, Parapta, Akkamian asked Kellis to describe the way he loved Serwe. Only he, Zynemis, and Kellis remained awake. They were all drunk.
Not the way you love Esmanette, the prince replied.
And how is that? How do I love her? He staggered to his feet, his arms askew. He swayed before the smoke and fire. Like a fish loves the ocean? Like
a drunk loves his cask, Zynemis chortled. Like my dog loves your leg.
Akkamian granted him that, but it was Kellis's answer he most wanted to hear. It was always Kellis's answer.
So, my prince, how do I love Esmanette?
Somehow a note of anger had crept into his tone. Kellis smiled, raised his downcast eyes. Tears scored his cheek.
Like a child, he said.
The words knocked Akkamian from his feet. He crashed to his buttocks with a grunt.
Yes,
Zynemis agreed. He looked forward into the night, smiling. Smiling for his friend, Akkamian realized.
Like a child?
Akkamian asked, feeling curiously childlike.
Yes, Kellis replied. You ask no questions, Akka. It simply is, without reserve.
He turned to him with the look Akkamian knew so well, the look he so often yearned for when others occupied Kellis's attention, the look of friend, father, student, and teacher, the look his heart could see.
She's become your ground, Kellis said.
Yes,
Akkamian replied.
She's become my wife. Such a thought.
He beamed with a childish glee. He felt wonderfully drunk.
My wife.
But later that same night, he somehow found himself making love to Serwe. Afterward, he would scarcely remember, but he'd awakened on a reed mat by the remains of the fire. He'd been dreaming of the white turrets of Mikle and rumors of Mog Farao. Zynemis and Kellis were gone, and the night sky seemed impossibly deep, the way it had looked that night he and Esmanette had slept out of doors at the ruined shrine, like an endless pit. Serwe knelt above him, as flawless as ivory in the firelight, at once smiling and crying.
What's wrong?
He gasped. But then he realized she'd hiked his robe to his waist and was rolling his cock against his belly. He was already hard, insanely so it seemed.
Serwe,
he managed to protest. But with each roll of her palm, bolts of rapture shuddered through him. He arched against the ground, straining to press himself into her hand. For some reason, it seemed that all he needed, all he'd ever needed, was to feel her fingers close about the head of his member.
No,
He moaned, digging his heels into the turf, clawing at the grass. What was happening? She released him, and he gasped at the kiss of cool air. He could feel his own fiery pulse. Something. He needed to say something. This couldn't be happening. But she'd slipped free her hassas, and he trembled at the sight of her. So lithe, so smooth, white in shadow, burnished gold in firelight, her peach hazed with tender blonde. She no longer touched him, yet her beauty flailed at him, wrenched at his groin. He swallowed, struggled to breathe. Then she straddled him. He glimpsed the porcelain sway of her breasts, the hairless curve of her belly. Is she with... She encompassed him. He cried out, cursed. It is you, she hissed, sobbing, staring desperately into his eyes. I can see you. I can see. He turned his head aside in delirium, afraid he would climax too soon. This was Serwe, sweet Sejanus, this was Serwe. Then he saw Esmanette standing desolate in the dark, watching. He closed his eyes, grimaced, and climaxed. I can feel you, Serwe cried. When he opened his eyes, Esmanette was gone, if she had ever been. Serwe continued to grind against him. The whole world had become a slurry of heat and wetness and thundering, aching, thrusting beauty. He surrendered to her abandon. Somehow he awoke before the horns and sat for a time at the entrance to his tent, watching Esmanette sleep, feeling the pinch of dried seed on his thighs. When she awoke, he searched her eyes but saw nothing. Through the hard, long march of the following day, she chastised him for drinking and nothing more. Serwe didn't so much as look at him. By the following evening, he'd convinced himself it had been a dream, a delicious dream. The Parapta. There could be no other explanation. Fucking fish liquor, he thought, and tried to feel ruefully amused. When he told Esmanette, she laughed and threatened to tell Kellis. Afterward, alone, he actually wept in relief. Never, he realized, not even the night following the madness with the Emperor beneath the Endymion Heights, had he felt a greater sense of doom. And he knew he belonged to Esme, not the world. She was his covenant. Esmanette was his wife. The holy war crept ever closer to Shygek, and still he ignored the mandate. There were excuses he could assemble. He could ponder the impossibility of making discreet inquiries, bribes, or dissembling suggestions in an encampment of armed fanatics. He could remind himself of what his school had done to Inrao, but ultimately they meant nothing. He would rush the enemy ranks. He would see his heresy through, to the end, no matter what horrors it might hold. For the first time in a long and wandering life, Drusus Akamian had found happiness. And peace had come. The day's march had been particularly trying, and Serwe sat by the fire, rubbing her toes while staring across the flames at her love, Kellis. If only it could always be like this. 4 days previous, Proyas had sent the Skilvendi south with several hundred knights to learn the ways into Shygek, Kellis had said. 4 days without chancing upon his famished glare, 4 days without cringing in his iron shadow as he escorted her to their pavilion, 4 days without his dread savagery. And each of them spent praying and praying, let him be killed. But this was the one prayer Kellis wouldn't answer. She stared and wondered and loved. His long blonde hair flashed golden in the firelight. His bearded features radiated good humor and understanding. He nodded as Akamian spoke to him about something, sorcery perhaps. She paid scant attention to the schoolman's words. She was too busy listening to Kellis's face. Never had she seen such beauty. There was something inexplicable, something godlike and surreal about his appearance, as though a breathtaking elegance, an impossible grace, lay hidden within his expressions, something that might flare at any moment and blind her with revelation, a face that made each moment, each heartbeat, a gift. She placed a hand on the gentle swell of her belly, and for an instant she thought she could feel the second heart within her, no larger than a sparrow's, drumming through moment after thickening moment. His child. His. So much had changed. She was wise, far more so, she knew, than a girl of 20 summers should be. The world had chastened her, had shown her the impotence of outrage. First the Gonum sons and their cruel lusts, then Pantaruth and his unspeakable brutalities, then Neyur and his iron-willed madness. What could the outrage of a soft-skinned concubine mean to a man such as him? Just one more thing to be broken. She knew the futility, that the animal within would grovel, shriek, would place soothing lips around any man's cock for a moment of mercy, that it would do anything, sate any hunger, to survive. She'd been enlightened. Submission. Truth lay in submission. "You've surrendered, Serwe," Kellis had told her, "and by surrendering, you have conquered me." The days of nothing had passed. The world, Kellis said, had prepared her for him. She, Serwe Hil Kilyalti, was to be his sacred consort. She would bear the sons of the warrior prophet. What indignity, what suffering could compare with this? Certainly, she wept when the Skilvendi struck her, clenched her teeth in fury and gagging shame when he used her. But afterward, she knew, and Kellis had taught her that knowing was exalted above all other things. Neyur was a totem of the old dark world, the ancient outrage made flesh. For every god, Kellis had told her, there was a demon. For every god. The priests, both those of her father and those of the Gonum, had claimed the gods moved the souls of men. But Serwe knew the gods also moved as men. So often, watching Esmenet, Akamian, Zynemus, and the others about the fire, she would be amazed that they couldn't see, though sometimes she suspected that in their heart of hearts they knew and yet were stubborn. But then, unlike her, they didn't couple with a god and his guises. They hadn't been taught how to forgive, how to submit, as she'd been taught, though they learned slowly. She often glimpsed the small, sometimes lonely ways in which he instructed them, and it was a wondrous thing to watch a god instruct others. Even now, he instructed them. "No," Akamian was asserting. "We sorcerers are distinguished by our ability. You cast nobles by your blood. What does it matter whether other men recognize us as such? We are what we are." With smiling eyes, Kellis said, "Are you sure?" Serwe had seen this many times. The words would be simple, but the way would wrench at their hearts. "What do you mean?" Akamian said blankly. Kellis shrugged. "What if I were to tell you that I'm like you?" Zynemus's eyes flashed to Akamian, who laughed nervously. "Like me?" the schoolman asked. He licked his lips. "How so?"
"I can see the mark, Akka. I can see the bruise of your damnation."
"You jest!"
Akamian snapped, but his voice was strange.
Kellis had turned to Zynemus. "Do you see? A moment ago, I was no different from you. The distinction between us didn't exist until just—" "It still doesn't exist," Akamian blurted, his voice rising. "I would have you prove this."
Kellis studied the man, his look careful and troubled. "How does one prove what one sees?"
Zynemus, who seemed unperturbed, chuckled. "What is it, Akka? There's many who see your blasphemy, but choose not to speak it. Think of the College of Luthime." But Akamian had jumped to his feet, his expression bewildered, even panicked. "It's just that...
Serwe's thoughts leapt. "He knows, my love. Akamian knows what you are."
She flushed at the memory of the sorcerer between her legs, but then reminded herself that it wasn't Akamian whom she remembered. It was Kellis.
"You must know me, Serwe, in all my guises."
"There is a way to prove this," the schoolman exclaimed. He fixed them with a ludicrous stare, then, without warning, hurried off into the darkness.
Zynemus had begun muttering some joke, but just then Esmenet sat next to Serwe, smiling and frowning.
"Has Kellis worked him into a frenzy again?" she asked, handing Serwe a steaming bowl of spiced tea.
"Again," Serwe said, and grasped the proffered bowl.
She tipped a glittering drop to the earth before drinking. It tasted warm, coiled in her stomach like sun-hot silk.
Thank you, Esme.
Esmanette nodded, turned to Kellis and Zynemus. The previous night, Serway had cut Esmanette's black hair short, man-short, so that now she resembled a beautiful boy.
Almost as beautiful as me, Serway thought.
She'd never known a woman like Esmanette before, bold, with a tongue as wicked as any man's. She frightened Serway sometimes, with her ability to match the men word for word, joke for joke. Only Kellis could best her, but she had always been considerate. Serway had asked her once why she was so kind, and Esmanette had replied that the only peace she'd found as a harlot had been caring for those more vulnerable than her. When Serway insisted she was neither a whore nor vulnerable, Esmanette had smiled sadly, saying,
"We're all whores, Sercha."
And Serway had believed her. How couldn't she? It sounded so much like something Kellis might say. Esmanette turned to look at her.
Was the day's march hard on you, Sercha?
She smiled the way Serway's aunt had once smiled, with warmth and concern. But then her expression suddenly darkened, as though she'd glimpsed something disagreeable in Serway's face. Her eyes became hooded.
Esme?
Serway said.
Is something wrong?
Esmanette's look became far away. When it returned, her handsome face wrinkled into another smile, more sad but just as genuine. Serway looked nervously to her hands, suddenly terrified that Esmanette somehow knew. In her soul's eye, she glimpsed the Skilvendi toiling above her in the dark.
But it wasn't him. The hills, she said quickly. The hills are so hard. Kellis says he'll get me a mule.
Esmanette nodded.
Make sure he...
She paused, frowned at the darkness.
What's he up to now?
A Commian had returned from the darkness, bearing a small doll about as long as a forearm. He sat the doll down on the earth, with its back resting against the bone-like stone he'd been using as a seat moments earlier. With the exception of the head, it was carved from dark wood, with jointed limbs, a small rusty knife for a right hand, and engraved with rows of tiny text. The head, however, was a silken sack, shapeless and no larger than a poor man's purse. Staring at it, it suddenly seemed a dreadful thing to Serway. The firelight gleamed across its polished surfaces and gave the illusion that the words had been carved inches deep. The small shadow that framed it was black as pitch against the stone and shifted uneasily with a twining glitter of the flames. It looked like a little dead man propped before a towering fire.
Does a Commian scare you, Sercha?
Esmanette asked. Something wicked and mischievous glinted in her eyes. Serway thought about that night at the ruined shrine, when he'd sent light to the stars. She shook her head.
No,
she replied. He was too sad to frighten.
He will after this, Esmanette said.
He leaves for proof, Zynemus cheered. And he returns with a toy?
This is no toy, Akamian muttered, annoyed.
He's right, Kella said seriously. It is some kind of sorcerous artifact. I can see the mark.
Akamian looked at Kellis sharply but said nothing. The fire crackled and hissed. He finished adjusting the doll, took two steps back. Suddenly, framed by the darkness and the shining fires of the greater encampment, he seemed less a weary scholar and more a mandate schoolman. Serway shivered.
This is called a Wathi doll, he explained. Something I purchased from a Sansori witch a couple of years ago.
There's a soul trapped in this doll. Zynemus coughed wine through his nose.
Aka,
he rasped.
I won't tolerate.
Humor me, Zin, please. Kella says he's one of the few. This is the one way for him to prove it without damning himself, or you, Zin. Apparently for me it's already too late.
What should I do? Kellis asked.
Akamian knelt and fetched a twig from the ground at his feet. I'll simply scratch two words into the earth, and you'll speak them aloud. You won't be uttering a cant, so you won't be marked by the blood of the Anta. No one will look at you and know you for a sorcerer, and you'll still be pure enough to handle trinkets without discomfort. You'll just be uttering the artifact's cipher. The doll will awaken only if you truly are one of the few.
Why is it bad that anyone recognized Kellis as a sorcerer? Bloody Dinch asked.
Because he'd be damned, Zynemus nearly shouted.
That, Akamian acknowledged, and he'd quickly be dead. He'd be a sorcerer without a school, a wizard, and the schools don't brook wizards. Akamian turned to Esmanette. They exchanged a quick, worried look. Then he walked over to Kellis. Sadway could tell that a large part of him already regretted this spectacle. With a twig, Akamian deftly scratched a line of signs in the earth before Kellis's sandaled feet. Sadway assumed that they were two words, but she couldn't read. I've written them in Cunayuric, he said, to spare the others any indignity. He stepped back, nodded slowly. Despite the brown of innumerable days spent in the sun, he looked gray. Speak them, he instructed. Kellis, his bearded face solemn, studied the words for a moment, then in a clear voice said, Skune arisitwa. All eyes scrutinized the doll lying slack against the stone in the firelight. Serwe held her breath. She'd expected that perhaps the limbs might twitch and then drawl into drunken life, as though the doll were a puppet, something that might prance on the end of invisible strings. But that didn't happen. The first thing to move, rather, was the stained silk head. But it didn't loll with lazy life, or even slowly nod. Instead, something moved from within. Serwe gasped in horror, realizing that a tiny face, nose, lips, brow, and eye sockets, now strained against the fabric. It was as though a narcotic haze had settled upon them, the torpor of bearing witness to the impossible. Serwe's heart hammered. Her thoughts wheeled, but she couldn't look away. A human face, small enough to palm, pressed against the silk. She could see tiny lips part in a soundless howl. And then the limbs moved, suddenly, deftly, with none of the swaying stagger of a puppet. Whatever moved those limbs moved them from within, with the compact elegance of a body assured of its extremities. And with half-panicked thoughts, Sarway understood that it was a soul, a self-moving soul. In a single languorous motion, it leaned forward, braced its arms against the earth, bent its knees, then came to its feet, casting a slender shadow across the earth, the shadow of a man with a sack bound about his head.
By all that's holy,
Bloody Dinch hissed in a breathless voice. The wooden man turned its eyeless face from side to side, studied the dumbstruck giants. It raised the small, rusty blade it possessed in lieu of a right hand. The fire popped, and it jumped and whirled. A smoking coal bounced to a stop at its feet. Looking down, it knelt with the blade, flicked the coal back into the fire. Akamian muttered something unspeakable, and it collapsed in a jumble of splayed limbs. He looked blankly at Kellis, and in a voice as ashen as his expression said, So you're one of the few. Horror, Serwe thought. He was horrified. But why? Couldn't he see? Without warning, Zynemus leapt to his feet. Before Akamian could even glance at him, the marshal had seized his arm, yanked him violently about.
Why do you do this?
Zynemus cried, his face both pained and enraged.
You know that it's difficult enough for me to, you know? And now displays such as this? Blasphemy!
Stunned, Akamian looked at his friend aghast.
But sin, he cried.
This is what I am. Perhaps Proyas was right, he snapped.
With a growl, he thrust Akamian away, then paced off into the darkness. Esmanette leapt from her place by Serwe and grasped one of Akamian's slack hands, but the sorceress stared off into the blackness that had encompassed the marshal of Atrempus. Serwe could hear Esmanette's insistent whisper,
It's okay, Akka. Kellis will speak to him, show him his folly.
But Akamian, his face turned from those watching about the fire, pushed at her feebly. Still bewildered, her skin still tingling in dread, Serwe looked to Kellis beseechingly.
Please, you must make this better.
Zynemus must forgive Akamian this. They must all learn to forgive. Serwe didn't know when she'd begun speaking to him with her face, but she did it so often now that many times she couldn't sort what she'd told him from what she'd shown him. This was part of the infinite peace between them. Nothing was hidden.
and for some reason his look reminded her of something he'd once said.
I must reveal myself to them slowly, Serwe, slowly. Otherwise, they'll turn against me.
Late that night, Serwe was awakened by voices, angry voices just outside their tent. Reflexively, she grasped for her belly. Her innards churned with fright.
Dear God's mercy, please mercy.
The Skilvendi had returned, as she knew he would. Nothing could kill Neyor Ur-Skiotha, not so long as Serwe remained alive.
Not again. Please, please.
She could see nothing, but the menace of his presence already clutched at her, as though he were a wraith, something feral and malevolent, bent upon consuming her, scraping out her heart the way Sepaloran women scrape pelts clean with sharpened oyster shells. She began to cry, softly, secretly, so he wouldn't hear. Any moment, she knew, he would thrash into the tent, fill it with the stink of a man who just shed his hauberk, grip her about the throat, and...
Please, I know I'm supposed to be a good girl. I'll be a good girl, please.
She heard his harsh voice, low so as not to be overheard, but fierce nonetheless.
I tire of this, Dunyane.
Nutatharo hir muta.
Kellis replied, with an impassiveness that unnerved her, until she realized.
He's cold because he hates him. Hates him as I do.
I will not,
the Skilvendi spat.
Stop put, Joragring.
Because you ask me to. I tire hearing you defile my tongue. I tire of being mocked. I tire of these fools you ply. I tire of watching you defile my prize. My prize!
A moment of silence, buzzing ears. Both of us, Kellis said in Taut Shaik, have secured places of honor. Both of us have gained the ears of the great. What more could you want?
I want only one thing.
And together we walk the shortest path to... Kellis abruptly halted. A hard moment passed between them. You intend to leave, Kellis said. Laughter, like a wolf's growl broken into fragments.
There is no need to share the same yaksh.
Serwe gasped for air. The scar on her arm, the swazand the plainsman had given beneath the Hethanta Mountains, flared in sudden pain.
No, 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 no.
Proyas, Kellis said, his voice still blank. You intend to camp with Proyas?
Please, God, no.
I have come for my things, Neyor said. I have come for my prize.
Never in all her violent life had Serwe felt herself pitched upon such a precipice. The breath was choked from her mid-sob, and she became very still. The silence shrieked. Three heartbeats it took Kellis to answer, and for three heartbeats, her very life hung as though from a gibbet between the voices of men. She would die for him, she knew, and she would die without him. It seemed she'd always known this, from the first clumsy days of her childhood. She almost gagged for fear. And then Kellis said, No, Serwe stays with me. Numb relief, warm tears. The hard earth beneath her had become as fluid as the sea. Serwe very nearly swooned, and a voice that wasn't hers spoke through her anguish and her rapture and said,
Mercy, at last mercy.
She heard nothing of their ensuing argument. Succor and joy possessed their own thunder. But they didn't speak long, not with her weeping aloud. When Kellis returned to his place beside her, she threw herself upon him, showered him with desperate kisses, and held his strong body so tight she could scarcely breathe. And at last, when the great weariness of the unburdened overwhelmed her, and she lay spinning on the threshold of sweet, childlike sleep, she could feel calloused yet gentle fingers slowly caressing her cheek. A god touched her, watched over her with divine love. It's back to canvas. The thing called Sarcellus crouched as still as stone. The musk of the Skilvendi's fury permeated the night air, sweet and sharp, heady with the promise of blood. The sound of the woman weeping tugged at its groin. She might have been worth its fancy were it not for the smell of her fetus, which sickened. What passed for thought bolted through what passed for its soul.